I just casually looked towards the canal, and I saw what I thought was a mannequin.
August 2nd, 1998, a brilliant young scientist is found dead near the campus of Georgetown University. The gruesome murder shocked D.C., but she wasn't the killer's only victim.
He jumped into the door with a blanket.
Unknown Subject, Season 3 of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, follows one man's gruesome 9-year crime spree and detectives' never-ending pursuit to find him. I'm Paul Wagner, host of WTOP's American Nightmare podcast series, available October 4th on all podcast platforms.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
We begin with a rather big development from the trial of the suspected killer of the Savopoulos family and their housekeeper. That man took the stand in his own trial.
I mean, it's a perfect puzzle piece. It fits right in.
I know.
But the thing is, there's a way that makes me kind of suspicious of that.
You didn't know Ed died a year ago.
No, ma'am. I don't have no... I couldn't call Ed when I was locked up. Ed don't have a phone.
You had no idea.
No, ma'am.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare. Prosecutors said the reason that Sava, Amy, Philip Savopoulos, and Vera Figueroa were murdered was pure greed. Darren Wint wanted money, and he got it, $40,000. But if this crime was all about getting money, shouldn't there be evidence that Darren Wint planned it? There isn't any. It's one of those questions that has frustrated us through the trial and as we've worked on this podcast. Investigators pulled just about every search Darren Wint ever typed into his cell phone. We've already told you about some of those searches that took place after the murders. But before the murders, Darren's search history seems normal, to be honest. Searches for movies, TV shows, music, and cars. The spreadsheets of his searches were filled with queries for different kinds of luxury cars, like Audis, BMWs, Maseratis, Aston Martins, Range Rovers, Corvettes. And yes, Porsche 911 Turbos, the same make and model of the car the Savopoulos has owned, the same kind of car that was driven from their home after the murders and then later set on fire. Okay, so he searched for cars. But it's what he didn't search for that confounds us. Darren Wint never searched for the Savopoulos' address. He never searched for directions to 3201 Woodland Drive or even to the family's neighborhood. He never searched for American Ironworks, his old employer. In the months leading up to the murders, he never even searched the Savopoulos name. So, how did Darren know where they lived? Yes, he worked for Sava, but that was years ago. Ask yourself this. Do you know the street address of the CEO of your company? What about the company you worked for 10 years ago? There is nothing in Darren Wint's search history, nothing that we saw, that offers an answer. When Darren took the stand in his own defense, he didn't deny he was at the Savopoulos house in May 2015, but he had a simple explanation for how he got there. He never had to search for the address because he was taken there. Darren said on the morning of May 14th, hours before the Savopoulos' house went up in flames, his brother, Darrell Wint, picked him up in a Porsche 911 Turbo and drove him to Woodland Drive. In this episode, we're going to continue to lay out for you what happened during Darren Wint's cross-examination, as prosecutor Laura Bach tried to poke holes in his testimony. Darren took the stand and said he wasn't anywhere near the family's house on May 13th, the day Amy, Sava, Philip Savopoulos, and Vera Figueroa were taken hostage. He said he was staying at a friend's house, at Ed's house. We later learned Ed wasn't going to be taking the stand to vouch for his alibi. Ed was dead, so he couldn't account for Darren's whereabouts during the 22 hours the victims were taken captive and then killed. We had to take Darren's word for it. Darren testified he left his phone in his minivan that he loaned to his brothers, so he was stuck at Ed's house waiting for Darrell to come back. That's the part of his story where we pick up Laura Bach's cross-examination.
So I guess at what point is it too late to just get on a bus and go home?
I wouldn't say it was a point, but after the drinking, I fell asleep.
A reminder, these are not actually the voices of Laura Bach and Darren Wendt. Our colleagues Lauren Larson and Claude Jennings are reading from the D.C. Superior Court transcript.
Right, the drinking. When did you start the drinking?
Close to 5 o'clock.
So around 5 o'clock, you just start drinking?
I know Darrell was on his way back soon because he said between 5 and 6. Figured by the time I finished the first drink, he would be outside.
So you take one drink of what?
It was vodka. I know it was white. I don't know exactly what kind of vodka it was.
So you sat there all day, right?
Yes, ma'am.
What'd you do?
After Ed would fix cars, we're just outside and hang out and just talk.
So you're hanging out with Ed, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Outside?
And everybody else, yes, ma'am.
Well, who's everybody else?
All his friends comes and goes.
Who are they? Tell us who they are.
I don't know these people, ma'am.
So the only person you can remember is Ed, who's dead?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So you sit outside with Ed, and at 5 o'clock, you take a drink of vodka.
Yes, ma'am.
And then what happens?
And then we just have a conversation. I was waiting for Darrell to come back.
What are you guys talking about?
Talking about cars.
All right. You like cars, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You know a lot about cars, don't you?
I know a lot about them.
You wanted nice cars, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, nothing wrong with wanting nice cars, right?
No, ma'am.
Couldn't afford them, though, could you?
No, ma'am.
So Darrell doesn't come back. When do you start drinking some more?
I was just hanging out and drinking, waiting for Darrell, who was on his way back. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any idea what time you went to sleep?
No, ma'am. I just remember Ed telling me to lay on the couch for a minute.
And then it's one of those things where you doze off and you're kind of like, oh, goodness, I've been asleep for a couple of hours.
Yes, ma'am. I woke up and the place was kind of dark.
Okay, and that's around 1 a.m, you thought?
It was after 1, yes, ma'am.
Okay, and you knew that because why?
Because there's a big clock right there in the living room.
Sure, and then you go back to sleep?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and how long did you sleep that time?
I got back up around after 10 o'clock.
Prior to that, you didn't, you know, hear anybody, you know, kind of trying to wake you up or anything, right?
No, ma'am.
You didn't hear any loud, strange noises while you were sleeping?
No, ma'am. I didn't hear anything.
Okay. Nothing unusual, right?
No, ma'am.
No gunshots or anything like that?
No, ma'am.
During this part of her cross, we weren't sure why Laura Bach was asking Darren if he'd heard any loud, strange noises or gunshots while he was sleeping. You learn, sitting through hours of court testimony, that attorneys often ask questions without giving them any context, without signifying why they might matter. Usually, those little details that seem obscure at the time come back into play later on. So, even though we didn't know anything about any loud, strange noises at Ed's house, and apparently Darren didn't either, Laura Bach had something up her sleeve. Okay, back to the cross-examination.
And what happens when you wake up?
I washed my face and went outside.
And then what happens?
Then a blue convertible Porsche pulled up.
Okay, and it's not just a blue convertible Porsche, it's a special kind of blue Porsche, right?
I saw a convertible blue Porsche. I don't know what kind of Porsche it was.
When it pulls up, you know it's a 911 Turbo, right?
I know it's a 911 Turbo.
You know that's an expensive car, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You know it costs about 6 figures?
No, ma'am.
You didn't know that?
I just know it's not a regular car that anybody could own.
You know it's not a regular car that anybody could own, By that, you mean it's a very expensive car?
Yes, ma'am. I would think in the same price range of a BMW and Mercedes.
All right. So the blue Porsche pulls up, and this is who's in the car?
I didn't know who was in the car at first.
Well, at some point you figure it out, right?
Yeah, after he stepped out the car, I realized it was Darrell.
Now, at this point, Laura Bach zeroed in on the time when Darren said Darrell drove up in the Porsche. Darren said it was sometime after 10 in the morning. Why is that important?
You heard in trial, you heard Claudia Alfaro, the daughter of Vera Figueroa, testify that she saw Amy's blue Porsche at 9:30 in the morning on May 14th. You heard her testify to that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Remember, Claudia testified she and her dad went to Woodland Drive looking for Vera. When she was waiting in the car, Claudia texted her husband a few pictures of a Porsche parked on the street.
So you know that you can't say Darrell picked you up before 9:30, right? It's got to be after 10.
I'm telling you that because that's the truth.
I'm asking you, did you hear her testify to that?
Yes, ma'am.
You also had the phone records about where it was Sava Savopoulos' phone was bouncing off the cell towers. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And again, when we're talking about Sava Savopoulos' phone, and we'll get to this, we're talking about those two white iPhones that you had on May 14th. Is that right?
I don't know where those phones come from.
Really? You don't know that one of those phones or both of those phones belong to the Savopoulos's?
No, ma'am.
You haven't figured that out yet?
No, ma'am.
And you did not know that we had the records showing that inside of your phone, you had typed 24 and K about the location of the minivan?
Yes, ma'am.
And you knew all of that before coming in here with this timeline in terms of when it is Darrell Wendt just happens to show up at Ed's house on May 14th in this blue Porsche convertible.
I didn't come up with that timeline, ma'am. I'm telling you the truth of what happened.
You didn't come up with a timeline.
I'm just telling you the truth of when Darrell actually showed up.
You haven't been sitting over here writing a timeline?
Timeline of when Darrell showed up?
No, you haven't been sitting here at this table writing a timeline throughout this trial.
Writing a timeline?
Yes, writing a timeline.
No, ma'am.
You haven't been sitting here taking notes on what the witnesses are saying, writing a timeline.
I take notes, but not those kind of notes.
No timeline.
No, ma'am.
During the next court break, Judy Pipe asked the judge if she'd clarify to the jury that Darren Wendt had every right to hear all the evidence against him. It's a right enshrined in the Constitution. She argued it wasn't fair for Laura Bach to suggest his hearing other witnesses testify was somehow improper. Bach agreed. Darren had the right to hear the evidence against him as the defendant. But she said she wanted to point out to the jury, because of that, when he took the witness stand, it gave him the ability to craft his story around the evidence that was already presented. The judge agreed to say to the jurors, to instruct them, that Darren Wendt had a constitutional right to be in the courtroom and to hear all the evidence against him. And the trial resumed. At this point in her cross-examination, Laura Bach starts to ask Darren about what he said happened when he arrived at the Savopoulos house with Darrell.
And when you get to the house on Woodland Drive, Darrell parks the car, according to you, on the street in front of the house. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And Darrell goes up, opens the door, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Not wearing gloves, just unlocks the door, right?
I didn't notice nothing. I just know he ran in the door.
So he could have been wearing gloves now.
He could have been, or he might not. I didn't pay too much attention.
Was he wearing gloves in the Porsche?
I wasn't paying attention.
You wouldn't have noticed if he had big construction gloves on as he's driving?
I would, yeah.
So was he wearing gloves when he's driving the Porsche?
I can't remember if I actually paid that much attention.
So you don't remember if he's wearing gloves?
No, ma'am.
No, you can't remember, or no, he wasn't?
I can't remember if he was wearing gloves. I didn't pay that much attention.
So you didn't pay attention to whether he was wearing gloves in the Porsche?
No, ma'am.
You go up to the house. You don't know if he's wearing gloves when he gets to the house?
No, ma'am.
But he opens the door. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you think you're going there to go do 30 minutes worth of work. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. Some painting, drywall. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so you get there. You have to do 30 minutes worth of work, right?
Yes, ma'am.
That's it?
Yes, ma'am.
And then hopefully, at that point, you can get your minivan and go home, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And so you get in there and you decide to go have a seat in this sort of nice receiving room, right?
Yes. Darrell told me sit right here.
That's what you do when you go work in somebody's house?
That's what he told me to do.
I'm asking, that's what you did?
Yes, ma'am. That's what I did.
Okay, and in comes Darrell with this pizza box. Now, he definitely has gloves on, you think, right?
After he opened the box is when I noticed the gloves.
You don't even know that he had the gloves on when he brought the box in?
Can you repeat the question?
So you don't actually see him wearing gloves when he brings the box in?
When he brings in the box?
Just explain to me how he brings the box in.
Okay, he went up the steps. I know he went up the steps because I hear the footprint. He came back down with the box, and he opened the box with the gloves. And I said, why are you holding the pizza you're about to give me to eat with these dirty gloves? And he's like, I'm just ready to work. He said, I have the box. I'm not grabbing the pizza.
So he brings down a pizza box, sits it on the table, opens it up for you?
Yes, ma'am.
With these dirty gloves on?
Yes, ma'am.
And then what do you do?
I took a slice.
And where's Darrell?
Darrell is standing right there.
He just stood there and watched you eat it?
Well, I don't know if he was watching me eat it. That'd be kind of creepy.
Right. It would be kind of creepy. So what does he do?
He's just standing there talking to me while I was eating pizza.
Does he stand there the whole time?
I think so. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And while you're in the house, don't hear any noises upstairs?
No, ma'am.
Don't hear any chairs making any noises, right?
No, ma'am.
No scratching on the floor?
No, ma'am.
Don't hear any dogs either, do you?
I hear the dogs, ma'am.
Oh, you did hear dogs?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, when did you hear the dogs?
I just heard barking.
You heard barking? When did you hear the barking?
When I was sitting at the table.
Oh, when you were sitting at the table. The whole time or just part of the time?
The whole time.
The whole time. Was it loud? Was it quiet?
The dog barks?
Yeah, the dog barks.
I don't know if it was loud or, but there was dogs barking. I would say loud.
Did they sound close or far away?
They sounded like they was behind where I was sitting.
And I guess you just failed to mention that on direct?
Judy Pipe objected, and the judge asked Laura Bach to rephrase her question.
I'm just asking, did you mention that yesterday?
I can't recall. I don't think I was even asked the question.
Well, you were asked yesterday if you heard any noises and you said no. Do you remember that?
The question was if I heard any noise. And okay, yes, I didn't mention that.
This actually seemed like a pretty big deal. We know the family's two Chesapeake Bay retrievers, Ginger and Bear, were at the house at the time that Amy, Sava, Philip, and Vera were killed. When the wallpaper installer, Donald Spence, called 911, he said he could hear the dogs inside. But in the very detailed story that Darren laid out for his lawyer, of going to the house with his brother and sitting down in a fancy receiving room and eating that slice of pizza, he never said anything about hearing dogs bark. Maybe he didn't think it was important. Maybe he forgot about the dogs. Or maybe he couldn't tell anymore what was the truth and what was a lie. Hi guys, Megan here. In addition to 22 Hours, I'm also working on a new podcast for WTOP called The DMV Download. We are taking a deep dive into the biggest, most interesting local stories of the day that are happening around DC. So if you enjoy hearing me here, it's a little bit of a different vibe, but I hope you'll check out The DMV Download. Thanks. Darren Wendt is going up against DC's top homicide prosecutor, Laura Bach. They both clearly have their own agenda. She's trying to get him to trip up and reveal holes in his story of what happened on May 13th and 14th of 2015. He's trying to get out of this without incriminating himself. We pick up after Darren testified he ate the slice of pizza inside the Savopoulos' house. He then said he went out to the Porsche to retrieve his phone and that his brother Darrell had told him to meet him around the side of the house in the garage. That's when two grounds workers at the Australian ambassador's residence across the street saw a black man with dreadlocks and a string backpack slip under the garage door as it was opening. They said he never touched the door. It seemingly opened for him, and closed behind him.
Now, Mr. Wendt, when you go into the garage at 3201 Woodland, you actually go into the garage by yourself, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when you go into the garage, what time is it?
It had to be around 11:30. I mean, between like 11:45, 12 o'clock.
Okay, is Darrell in the garage?
Yes, ma'am.
What's Darrell doing?
He's just standing there.
Okay, and then what happens?
And then he just hands me a green construction vest.
And you just put it on?
Yes, ma'am.
And he hands you a hard hat?
Yes, ma'am.
And you just put it on?
Yes, ma'am.
No idea why at that point?
No, but I asked him.
Okay, so you put them on, and then you ask him, why am I putting these on?
Yeah, why do I need it just to do some paint and drywall in the house?
And it's at that point that you said he tells you, we'll be less conspicuous unloading the house if you're wearing these things, right?
Yes, not those terms, but yes.
The point is, you're not going to stand out as much if you're wearing a construction vest, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Because it'll look like you're working on the house, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when he said to you about unloading the house, you knew what he meant, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you don't want any part of that. That's your testimony.
No, ma'am.
And you're upset, right?
Because I'm here to do some honest work, not to steal from the house.
Right. You're upset.
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, your brother's just totally lied to you, right?
Well, yes, ma'am.
Yeah. He told you this was honest work, right?
Yes.
And he's lied to you, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And he got you into something that you weren't expecting, right?
Yes, ma'am. I'm not stealing.
Right, because that's not what you were up there to do, right?
No, ma'am.
And you took off that hard hat and you threw it on the ground, right?
Yes, ma'am. I was upset.
Because you were angry, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you stormed out of that garage, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, how'd you get out?
He opened the door.
Oh, he opened the door back up for you?
Yes, ma'am.
As you're storming out?
I couldn't open the garage door. He locked it.
So he opens up the big garage door for you?
No, I was walking up there, the garage door opened, and I ducked under and went in.
I'm asking you how you go out.
Laura Bach's unrelenting cross-examination was beginning to weaken Darren's story. He said he just slipped into the garage, got in an argument with his brother, and stormed out. But it doesn't really make sense. In his story, Darren's refusing to do what his brother wants. He throws the hard hat, he's so mad. And when he turns to leave, Darrell helpfully opens the garage door for him. And then as he walked away from the garage, about 5-10 minutes later, he said Darrell drives up beside him in the Porsche.
When he pulls up, he said, get in. I said, no. He said, I'm taking you to your van, and I get in.
So even though he's just asked you to rob or burglarize a house, you get in the car?
Yes, ma'am. I wanted to get to my van.
And let's just talk for a moment about this car. You said it's, in your mind, it's like a BMW, right?
I mean, it's just as expensive, yes, ma'am.
Tell me this. You knew the Porsche wasn't Darrell's?
Yes, ma'am. I knew it wasn't.
He just asked you to steal everything from these people's home, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you decided to just get in the car with him because he said he'll take you to this van, right?
Because I don't think nobody will be driving around in a stolen car.
Really? You didn't think he might drive around in a stolen car?
No, ma'am.
And according to you, he lied to you about the fact that it was a legitimate job, right?
Yes, ma'am.
According to you, he lied to you about why he needed your van, right?
Yes, ma'am.
According to you, he lied to you when he said he was coming back to get you on May 13th, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And according to you, he lied to you when he said he needed to take you there for 30 more minutes of work. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
But you thought that he would be totally above board about this car that he was driving that he can't afford.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to get to my van.
I never thought about from a prosecutor's standpoint. You have to be aggressive enough that the person looks bad and looks guilty, but you don't want to put them in a position where they look like they're being picked on or vulnerable. You know, like you don't want the jury to see them as the victim.
That's audio of a call I made to Jack on the day of Darren's cross-examination.
And we bordered that. And this other reporter agreed with me. he kind of had the impression that her demeanor went a little bit over the top. Like, she raised her voice a lot. She kind of repeated the same questions over and over again. And she was a little hostile in how she asked the questions. It was bordering on bullying. And it was good. A lot of that strategy got answers, right? Like, got answers from Wint that she wanted and got him to kind of, like, falter in his storyline.
We asked Glenn Kirshner about the strategy behind questioning a defendant. He's the former federal prosecutor who hired Laura Bach and led the homicide division at the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office.
How do you do that? You know, you want to show the jury that, you know, you're not buying the story, but you also don't want to make them come across as sympathetic for any reason.
It's an art, not a science. And everything that Laura does in court, every question she asks a defendant on cross-examination, she's aware of the impact it has on the jurors, because that's what it's all about. And yes, jurors want to see you push an accused killer hard on the stand and test every aspect of his or her story that they've just spit out on direct examination, which you know was extremely rehearsed, which you know was entirely exculpatory, designed to get him off whether he committed the crime or not. You know, and one thing that I always argue to my juries after a defendant chose to testify, very few homicide murder defendants choose to testify because it doesn't end well for them after we cross-examine them. But I tell every single jury, you know, ladies and gentlemen, when you saw that the defendant chose to testify and he got up from where you've seen him sitting behind defense table for this entire trial and he walked across the well of the courtroom and he sat his butt down in the witness chair, what did you expect him to say? Okay, you got me. I did it. No, he was going to have to come up with some ridiculous explanation for all of the incriminating evidence. Why? Because he wants to get away with a crime he committed. So jurors want to see you go hard after defendants.
Laura Bach certainly did that. Now we're to the part of Darren's testimony where he and his brother are leaving the Savopoulos neighborhood, driving out of D.C. in Amy's blue Porsche 911 toward Prince George's County, Maryland. Darren said they ended up pulling into that parking lot near the church in the LaFontaine Blue Shopping Center. That's where we pick up Laura Bach's cross-examination.
And just so we know and understand, you said that you were familiar with the area in that parking lot because you said your sister lives over there, right?
Yes, ma'am. My sister lives in the back, and my brother lives across the street.
And your brother is your brother Stefan, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, there's another reason you're familiar with that area, right?
Not to my knowledge right now, no.
Mr. Wint, who else used to live there?
Oh, me, yes.
Yeah, you.
Yes, ma'am.
Laura Bach then started describing that area around the parking lot. The overgrown brush and weeds that was full of trash.
There's a lot of, let's call it sketchy stuff, maybe, that goes on. Is that fair to say?
I never really pay attention to what goes on there.
You didn't ever see anybody there doing some illegal things sometimes?
No, ma'am.
You never saw anybody just kind of hanging out in that area?
People hangs out on the steps coming out of the walkway and in the church parking lot.
Okay, so people hang out in that area?
Yeah, people always hang out there.
All right. Drinking?
Yes.
Sometimes using drugs?
I would assume so, yes.
Maybe even some prostitution every once in a while?
I ain't see all that.
Jack and I had also noticed that tangled thicket when we went to visit the parking lot and spotted the charred patch of asphalt where the Porsche was burned. But during Laura Bach's cross-examination, we couldn't really figure out why she was asking these questions about rumors of sketchy stuff that apparently went on there.
So what happens when Durrell gets to this parking lot with you in the Porsche?
He said he got to pick somebody up at 5 o'clock to get done what he needed to get done. He can't take me to my van anymore.
Okay, then what happens?
And then I got pretty upset and stepped out of the Porsche and I threw the vest at him.
When you say pretty upset, what do you mean by that?
Upset to the fact is that first he was supposed to take me to my van. Second, take me to a house where you're stealing stuff. Third, he brought me all the way to Maryland and back, and I didn't get my van yet.
So what happens at that point?
the rail pulled off.
Okay, so you're standing there. You've thrown the vest at him. Where do you go?
I was about to walk over to the bus stop.
Okay, and what happens as you're walking over there?
I realized Darrell hadn't given me the keys to my van.
Had you asked him for them?
No, ma'am.
You asked him multiple times to take you to the minivan, but you never bothered to ask for the keys?
Because he... Yes, ma'am.
I'm asking yes or no. Is that what happened?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Darren testified earlier that when he realized he didn't have the keys, he walked over to Annapolis Road and flagged down a tow truck driver. Darren said he paid the driver $100 from the $300 Darrell had given him, and then rode with the driver to 24th and K Streets in downtown D.C. to get his van. During the trip, he's sending texts and calling different people from the driver's phone, including Darrell. But why did Darren have his van towed back to the parking lot? Laura Bach made it clear that didn't make sense.
And again, why did you think Darrell's going to be here?
Because he's supposed to come back and pick somebody up, he said.
So he said he was actually going to pick them up right here?
Yes, ma'am.
And this is the same Darrell who's lied to you, what, 6-7 times at this point?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, and Darrell knows where your father Dennis lives, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, because that's his dad, too?
Yes, ma'am.
And Darrell easily could have just met you at your dad's house, right?
Yes, ma'am.
No reason why that van couldn't have been towed to your dad's house.
No, ma'am.
All right, but instead of towing the van to your dad's house, you decide to have it towed to the very place where the Porsche starts burning within an hour. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And the only reason you had your minivan towed, you said, is because you didn't have your keys, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, there's other reasons why you don't want to be driving an unregistered minivan, right?
I mean, the fact it's unregistered.
Well, right. What happens when you're driving an unregistered minivan sometimes?
It's unregistered.
Well, yeah, you get pulled over, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You get stopped by the police, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when the police stop you, they don't just stop you. They look in your car, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And if you've got any stuff that you've maybe just taken out of a house, they might see it, right?
I don't understand that question.
Well, if you've got stuff that you shouldn't have in your minivan, the police might see it if they stop it, don't you think?
Well, the police won't know what I should or should not have.
You don't think they would maybe recognize bloody clothes?
Yes, they would recognize bloody clothes.
Okay, so that would be the kind of stuff you don't want the police to see?
I mean, if you commit a crime, I wouldn't think so, no.
The mystery of why Darren might have wanted his van towed didn't seem so mysterious anymore. He couldn't risk getting pulled over for a driving violation. The police might search his minivan, or take it and arrest him.
And you were very, very concerned about your minivan getting linked to 3201 Woodland Drive, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
You had concerns that you might also be arrested, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you thought you might also be arrested because your van could be connected to that scene.
Yes, ma'am.
And so that's why you felt the need to call Mr. Ayling to have him help you burn your minivan. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you thought it could be connected to the fire?
Yes, ma'am, because Darrell wasn't telling me anything.
And an hour after that phone call to Mr. Ayling asking him to help you burn the minivan is burned, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And
I think that's the time. I'm not sure.
You don't remember that testimony?
I can't remember the time it was burned.
Well, you heard Mr. Ayling testify that he talked to you at 11:16 on May 15th, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you heard the fire department, or the firefighter, indicate that he responded to the scene of 51st and Froelich right around 12:30 on May 16th, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So that's a little over an hour, right?
Yes, ma'am.
But you didn't have anything to do with it?
No, ma'am.
And 51st and Froelich, again, that's the same location. It's less than a block away from where you worked for 8 or 9 years, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And one of the things that you told us was that when you first saw the news that that house had caught on fire and those people had been killed, the very first thing that you looked up was how to beat a lie detector test. Do you remember that?
Yes, ma'am.
And the reason you looked it up was your very first thought was, I'm going to have to lie to the police about this.
Yes, ma'am, because if my van was involved, they would be questioning me about my van.
Your very first instinct was that you were going to lie to the police.
Yes, ma'am.
Darren Wint spent an entire day on the witness stand being grilled by Laura Bach. Several of the exchanges were uncomfortable to watch. On TV, big courtroom scenes are always dramatic and exciting. But in real life, the exchanges were mostly about the minutiae of the case. Sometimes they were awkward, and they often fell short of the drama you'd expect. But as she approached the end of her cross-examination, the tension in the room began to ratchet up.
All right, and we've already established you went to the gym all the time, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You were not going to have any problem overpowering a 5'8" man, are you?
I was strong. I don't think so.
Okay, you're not going to have any problem overpowering a 57-year-old female, right?
No, ma'am. I don't think so.
You're not going to have any problem overpowering a 5'4", 138-pound woman, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you can certainly overpower a 10-year-old boy, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
You've lied to Vanessa, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You've lied to your father, Dennis, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You've lied to your stepmother, Pam, right?
Yes, ma'am.
You've lied to the police, right?
I didn't lie to my stepmother.
You didn't lie to your stepmother.
I can't remember. When did I tell her a lie?
You didn't lie to your stepmother about where you'd been on May 14th and May 13th?
We didn't have that. I was having a conversation with my father.
Oh, so she was just overhearing it, but it wasn't directly to her?
Yes, ma'am.
You were not at home on May 13th and May 14th of 2015, is that right?
No, ma'am.
And you were at 3201 Woodland on May 14th?
No, ma'am.
On May 14th, you were at 3201 Woodland, right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
You're the guy whose DNA is on the pizza crust, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're the guy whose DNA is on the pizza crust because you're the guy who's eating pizza in that house, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
On May 14th.
Yes, ma'am.
And just so everybody, I guess, is aware, you're the guy who's wearing the construction vest that's found in that burned-up Porsche. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it's your DNA on that construction vest, right?
I would assume so. Yes, ma'am. I was wearing the construction vest, so probably yes, ma'am.
And your DNA is on it because you're wearing it, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're wearing it at 3201 Woodland, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And your hair is in the hard hat, right?
I don't know. I put the hard hat on. I don't know whose hair it is.
Well, you're the one who put it on your head, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you put it on your head inside of 3201 Woodland, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that would certainly explain why your hair would be in the hard hat, right?
Yes, ma'am, because I had it on.
Because you had it on at that location, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Just like you had the knife at that location, right?
No, ma'am.
Just like you had your hair in that room with those three dead people in that location, right?
No, ma'am.
Your hair in the bed next to the bat you used to kill Amy and Sava Savopoulos. Isn't that right?
No, ma'am.
I don't have anything else, Your Honor.
And with that, Laura Bach ended her cross-examination of Darren Wint. Was it Darren's idea to take the stand in his own defense? We'll probably never know for certain. That falls under attorney-client privilege. But from a defense attorney's perspective, the decision was unusual.
In a murder case like this, how badly do you not want your client to take the stand?
I mean, I've tried several murder cases, and I may have called one client to the stand total in my entire career on a murder case.
That's Jason Downs. He used to work with Judy Pipe at the D.C. Public Defender Service, and is now in private practice. We asked him about the strategy of putting a defendant on the stand.
It's usually because it is so difficult to undergo cross-examination. Doesn't matter if you're telling the truth or not. Getting cross-examined is hard for anybody. And so you usually don't want to put your client under that kind of pressure. So I would go out of my way to keep my client off the stand in a general murder case. If Judy put her client on, there was a very, very good reason for it.
It did answer some questions in this case. Having Darren take the stand provided an alternative explanation for some of the evidence. How his DNA got on the pizza crust. Why he was going into the Savopoulos' garage when the witnesses saw him slip under the door. And why he had no cell phone activity during the majority of those 2 days. If Darren didn't testify, there wouldn't have been much of a defense case at all. The prosecution's case lasted nearly a month. The defense, including Darren's 2 days on the stand, didn't even last a week. Hearing Darren tell his side of the story gave jurors the opportunity to weigh two competing theories of the case. Yes, the prosecution's narrative had gaps, but so did Darren's. Parts of it really didn't stand up to scrutiny. So we don't know if it was his idea, but whether he took the stand was completely up to Darren.
I know Judy well enough to know that she takes her job so seriously that she would have had a very long conversation, probably multiple conversations, with her client and told him the positives and the negatives about testifying. And then, because she takes her job so seriously, she would have left the decision to him, because it's his decision and his decision alone, and she would not want to rob him of that decision.
After Laura Bach's cross-examination, Judy Pipe got a chance to ask her client a few more questions on redirect. She started with one of Laura Bach's attack lines, that Darren was fabricating his defense, fitting it around the timeline and evidence collected by prosecutors. The legal term for that kind of evidence, that prosecutors have to turn over to defense attorneys, is called discovery. While Judy Pipe maintained that Darren had the right to see the discovery, she revealed during one of those conferences at the bench that it was her practice in this case not to hand Darren the witness statements before they took the stand. We're not sure why she did this. Maybe it was to prevent him from being accused of fabricating a defense based on the evidence. But when she tried to clarify his motives in making a timeline, it didn't go very smoothly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wint.
Good afternoon.
Now, the government has asked you a lot of questions about your knowledge about the evidence in this case. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Was there a whole lot of discovery in this case?
Yes, ma'am.
Are we talking thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of discovery?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Have you looked at a lot of it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Have you looked at all of it?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
We asked our content advisor, Julia Ziegler, to read Judy Pipe's part in the transcript. And again, our colleague Claude Jennings is reading the part of Darren. This is all word for word from the D.C. Superior Court transcript of the trial.
Let's talk about statements from witnesses. The government asked you a lot of questions about that.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you aware that when witnesses go to the grand jury, there's a transcript made?
I learned that during the trial, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Prior to this trial starting, did anyone give you copies of those transcripts?
No, ma'am.
Did anybody read you copies of those transcripts?
No, ma'am.
Did anyone sit there while you read copies of those transcripts?
No, ma'am.
Did you eventually, at some point, read some of those transcripts?
Yes, ma'am.
When?
When they was on the stand.
All of the transcripts that you have read, are they for witnesses who have testified in this case?
I'm confused by that question.
I did say that weird. You've said you've read some witnesses' transcripts, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Every transcript that you've read, is that of a witness who took the stand in this case?
No, ma'am.
Okay. You've read transcripts of witnesses who did not testify?
I read transcripts, right. I read transcripts for witnesses that didn't take the stand.
You read some who did not testify?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. When have you read those?
I can't remember, but it was a while back.
Was it before or after this trial started?
Before the trial started.
Did you understand what I was asking you?
Okay. I read the transcript for witnesses that did not testify, but witnesses that testified, I didn't read anything.
Okay.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
I mean, okay. Everybody that took the stand.
Let me try this again. Okay. We talked about before. Did you read any transcripts before this trial started?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Once this trial started, did you read some transcripts?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. When I say take the stand, people who were sitting in that same exact chair that you are sitting in, right?
Yes, ma'am. That's the transcripts that I read.
Okay. Have you read any transcripts of witnesses who did not sit in that seat where you are sitting?
No, ma'am.
Has it been a very long day for you, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
It's clear there was a lot of confusion between Darren Wendt and his own attorney during her attempts to clarify for the jury how he accessed the evidence against him. So eventually, Judy Pipe just went right to the point.
Are you trying to craft your testimony to match what the witnesses have said in this trial, Mr. Wendt?
No, ma'am.
What are you trying to testify to?
Just the way I remember it.
So when Miss Bach was asking you questions, were you trying to be accurate with your answers?
Yes, ma'am.
Were you being a bit cautious with your words?
Yes, ma'am.
Why?
Because I know the government could take your words and twist it and turn it to how it best suits them.
Judy Pipe then returned to some specific questions Laura Bach raised in her cross.
Okay. Miss Bach asked you questions about what you heard while you were in the house. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you remember her saying that you never mentioned the dogs on direct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did I ask you about hearing dogs on direct?
No, ma'am.
So is that my fault?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Did I ask you what you heard while you were in the house, or did I ask you, did you hear anyone upstairs?
You asked me if I heard anyone upstairs.
Okay. If I had asked you, did you hear anything in that house, what would your answer have been?
I hear dogs.
Miss Bach asked you a lot of questions about kind of your physical state back in May of 2015. Do you remember those?
Yes, ma'am.
She asked you whether or not you could overpower people. Do you remember those questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you ever overpower anyone in May of 2015?
No, ma'am.
Did you overpower Sava Savopoulos?
No, ma'am.
Did you overpower Amy Savopoulos?
No, ma'am.
Philip Savopoulos?
No, ma'am.
Vera Figueroa?
No, ma'am.
Did you ever see them while you were in the house at 3201 Woodland Drive?
No, ma'am.
Did you have anything to do with what happened to those people?
No, ma'am.
I don't have any further questions.
Finally, after 2 days on the witness stand, Darren Wendt stepped down and went to take a seat next to his attorneys. After Darren's testimony, the defense called a few more witnesses, starting with Ed's neighbors. Judy Pipe had to prove that Ed really did exist. They said yes, they knew of Ed, and yes, he was the kind of guy who would work on your car for a few bucks, the kind of guy who would do pretty much anything for a few bucks. And yes, Ed was still very much dead. As the defense was preparing to wind down its case, Jack and I wondered what would come next. Legally, the next phase of the trial is what's called rebuttal. The prosecution can come back and call new witnesses. But there's a catch. Prosecutors can only call witnesses who can specifically refute points the defense brought up in its case.
So I was Googling around and I was reading that sometimes the rebuttal phase is when the prosecution springs a surprise. That's when they can do that, because before that they really can't.
This is another call between Jack and I during the trial. He said, unlike discovery, when the prosecution has to share what it has against the defense before the trial begins, it does not have to reveal its plan for rebuttal.
But maybe they're holding something back in their back pocket for the rebuttal. Like, maybe they were planning this all along.
Maybe. I don't know what they, what could the surprise possibly be?
It seemed to us that Darren taking the stand would probably be the biggest surprise of the trial. But there was one witness we hadn't heard from. Darrell Wendt. We couldn't figure out why prosecutors hadn't called Darrell already. For one thing, we knew going into the trial that Darrell was with Darren when he was arrested. Darrell had been taken into custody that night too, and certainly that seemed relevant. And during the defense's case, when prosecutor Laura Bach was cross-examining Darren Wendt, we learned Darrell had a larger role in the case than we thought. Again, this is Laura Bach cross-examining Darren.
Now, you know in this case that one of the things that you were provided with is the information that Darrell provided to the government. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And when I say the information, I mean interviews, right?
Yes, ma'am. Well, correction. I don't think there's a statement from Darrell.
You didn't see the interview from the night that you guys were all arrested? Or that you were all stopped?
No, ma'am.
You're telling us you don't know that Durrell gave us a statement that night you were stopped?
I have no, ma'am.
You have no idea?
I know the most I know, he was supposed to be testifying. But I haven't seen no interview.
All right. When you say testifying, you mean against you?
I mean coming into the court.
Against you?
Yes, ma'am.
Judy Pipe objected, and the lawyers approached the judge's bench. The judge flipped on the white noise machine again. The transcript reads, Judy Pipe argued prosecutors were improperly taking advantage of having Darren on the stand to bring up Durrell. She said her client wasn't aware what Durrell told police, and if prosecutors wanted to talk about what Durrell did or didn't do, they should have called him as a witness. Bach countered, arguing Darren was trying to frame his brother because of what Durrell had told police. The judge allowed Laura Bach to continue, and her next question spelled it all out.
Let me try to ask it, I guess, as direct as possible. You know that Durrell took the police to a location in that block and pointed out a pile of burned debris in that area. Is that right?
No, ma'am.
And you know that he indicated that you were the one who burned that debris?
No, ma'am.
You didn't know that?
No, ma'am.
You had no idea?
No, ma'am.
And you never saw any photographs of burned debris, not from a minivan, but another pile further down that block of burned debris?
Yes, ma'am. I saw those photographs.
You did see those photographs?
Yes, ma'am.
And you saw the evidence in those photographs?
Yes, ma'am.
But you had no idea what it had to do with your case?
No, ma'am.
And you just kind of threw up your hands like, oh, well, don't care.
I mean, I know this is part of the case because my lawyer had it. They wouldn't have nothing that's not part of the case.
But you didn't know where that information was coming from?
I mean, it's coming from the government.
You didn't know it was coming directly from your brother?
No, ma'am.
Laura Bach asked the judge to approach the witness stand. She walked up to Darren and handed him a photo. We got a copy later from prosecutors. In it, you can see a small pile of ash and other blackened debris. Now, to be clear, this is not at the Savopoulos house. It's not the same fire where the Porsche was burned. It's not the fire where Darren's van was burned. There's a fourth fire in this case, and it happened just down the road from where firefighters found Darren's burning minivan. It's clear from the photograph of the fourth fire scene, something was burned there, but you can't really tell what. Except if you zoom in on what looks like wires at the edges of the pile, you can see they're black zip ties. Like the zip ties investigators believe were used to restrain Sava Savopoulos.
You've seen that photograph before, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're telling us that you had no idea that information came from your brother, Durrell?
No, ma'am.
It turned out Darren's brother, Durrell, had been cooperating with prosecutors. He'd answered detectives' questions, and he'd led them to a potential key piece of evidence. Now, the question on everyone's mind was, where's Durrell? On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare.
The motive in the case being all about the money is not really explained by the brutality of the crime.
Because 40 grand, well, it means a lot of money. But when you hear four people were killed and he left with 40 grand, it's like, well, that's it.
We change things up and go into the studio with a guest to answer your questions so far in this case.
But my brain goes to, well, where was Philip when the intruder came in?
22 Hours, An American Nightmare was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks to her, Lauren Larson, and Claude Jennings for reading the testimony. And thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate this podcast and subscribe. We have the full transcript of Darren's cross-examination at 22HoursPodcast.com, where you can also see a map of locations mentioned in this podcast. Send us feedback on the blog or on Twitter at 22HoursPod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam, Cast of Pods by Doug Maxwell, and Spookster by Wayne Jones, both available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse by Daniel Birch is licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.